Hello, everybody. Welcome and thank you for coming. My name is Reem Ramawi, and I'm the president of Students for Justice in Palestine here at UNO. I would like to introduce David Sheen, a Canadian-Israeli independent journalist and filmmaker. Sheen began blogging when he first moved to Israel in 1999 and has written for many publications, including Al Jazeera, Huffington Post, and The Daily Beast. He has spoken throughout the U.S., Canada, and Europe, and is currently writing a book about African immigrants to Israel and the struggles that they face. Welcome to David Sheen.
Thank you so much for coming. People who weren't able to come out tonight will be able to see this material. And of course, I'm also going to be adding URLs so that when you see some of this stuff, you may find it hard to believe. You'll be able to go onto the internet afterwards and look this stuff up and verify. With the title that I've chosen, The Bullet, The Ballot, and The Boycott, people generally assume that I'm going to be speaking about boycotting Israel. But in fact, I'm not going to be speaking about boycotting Israel. I'm going to be speaking about Israel boycotting. Because I contend that Israel actually boycotts its own non-Jewish citizens in many facets of life. I've only been talking about what's happening inside pre-1967 Israel. Because there's this discourse of liberal Zionists, and when the idea of boycotting Israel comes up, you know, then they're quick to jump in and say, wait a minute, that's not fair. It's not fair to boycott Israel, because if you're opposed to what Israel's doing in the territories, then you should boycott the territories. You should boycott the settlements. You should boycott goods and services that come out of the settlements. But don't boycott Israel. That's a separate entity altogether. Fine. In the West Bank, that's non-democratic Israel. But in the rest of the country, that's democratic Israel. Those are two separate entities. Now, of course, it's completely ridiculous. This is an artificial separation that has no basis in reality, right? That's so-called democratic Israel, where Palestinian people are boycotted. This is what I'm trying to explain to you, that Israel isn't a democracy, that in my mind it's an ethnocracy, and that the rights and privileges are not accorded to people on the basis of citizenship, but on the basis of their ethnicity. That's bad enough, and no one should have to live like that one more day. But what's even worse is that we see in recent years there are forces within the society that are trying to take that ethnocracy and turn it into a theocracy. The goal of these Jewish dominionist groups, as I call them, is they want to create a theocracy. The strategy, the way to get there, is race war. That's what they want to pop off. And the tactics they're using to ignite that race war is arson, burning Palestinian trees, Palestinian cars, Palestinian mosques, Palestinian churches. And we see, in case you were wondering, we're not just talking about random acts of vandalism where they leave graffiti at the scene of the crime, explaining in no uncertain terms why they do it. Now keep in mind, not just burning mosques and churches, but even burning schools in Israel. I've made the case for how these Jewish dominionists are slowly sweeping into power, taking over, but if there was any doubt about it, we have the words of Israel's defense minister, Moshe Alon, who, talking about the Dawabshah family that was burned to death over 100 days ago, till this day, we don't have any indictment. We don't have anyone on trial. We don't have any names or faces. And it's not because we don't know who did it. So in the interests of being able to continue to spy on these groups, they're willing to keep them in the dark, and it's not important enough to bring these murderers to trial. Even the death of a Palestinian baby. That's how little Palestinian lives matter. As I explained earlier, it's not, you know, here when we see mixed couples, we're like, oh, that's so cute. Look at them. You know, like their kids are so beautiful. And that's, it gives me hope and stuff. But that's not how it's seen in Israel, okay? When you see Mark Zuckerberg, you don't think of, oh, that's a Jewish success story. According to the Israeli government, that's a failure because he chose to wed a non-Jewish partner. You know, this is how ridiculous the discourse is in Israel. You know, we have Michael Oren, the former Israel's ambassador to the U.S. until just recently, and now a lawmaker in the Knesset itself. He writes that Jews who marry non-Jews have a hard time understanding the Israeli character. You see, as soon as you mate with someone outside of the chosen people, somehow you lose 20 IQ points or something like that. I don't really understand this. And it's not just him. We have also another so-called centrist legislator, Elazar Stern. He talks about that Israel and America are facing a plague of intermarriage or whatever. That's what this says. That intermarriage, so-called marriage between Jews and non-Jews, is a problem not just in Israel but in America. See, it's not enough that they're conducting campaigns in Israel to prevent Jews and non-Jews from marrying one another, but they also want to end this phenomenon outside of Israel, including right here in the USA. And if you can imagine this, I mean, when we see this photo, the average, you know, I would think that what would run through your head is, oh, wow, this shows you what a success story. This Jewish man is married the daughter of the emperor and the empress of the American Empire. You know, this is a sign of success. But I guess, according to the Israeli government, it's something that needs to be combated. Because last year, if you can imagine this, the Israeli government spent $4 million of my tax money to prevent Jews and non-Jews from marrying each other. In other words, to convince Jews not to marry non-Jews, but not in Israel, outside of Israel, right here in New Orleans and across the USA and around the world. Okay? And if it's not bad enough, this year the government decided to raise that figure to $50 million. That's their eugenics program. It's not enough that they're running the eugenics program in Israel. They want to expand it to include the 50 states. Now, I described earlier one of these mixed couples, but increasingly it's not just Jews and Palestinians, it's also Jews and Africans. Because in recent years, we have also, for the first time in Israel's history at least, a wave of non-Jewish immigration to the country. Now, admittedly, if I was a racist and all of a sudden these cute, you know, Eritrean guys moved in and, you know, these hot Sudanese women immigrated to the country, I'd be like, oh man, I gotta step up my game. You know, all of a sudden I gotta look good, you know, like, because, you know, all of a sudden I got competition from some fine-looking foreigners. But, you know, all joking aside, this isn't a group of people who came here looking for love. You know, this is people who came looking for life. I mean, they fled some of the most horrific regimes in the world. We're talking about the regime of Bashir in Sudan, a man who is up on war crimes, crimes against humanity for the ethnic cleansings in Darfur. Okay, so people fleeing Sudan and fleeing Eritrea. It's considered the North Korea of Africa. This is a country that has never had a democratic election in its entire history. Okay, the same person has been ruling there since the 80s. We're talking about 63% of the population has only ever known him as a ruler. Okay, it's pretty much abject slavery for the entire population. And people are fleeing by the thousands every single month. Now, we're talking about a group of about 66,000 people. When they arrive in Israel in the last decade, the government doesn't want them in the country. It doesn't want to provide them with any services, with any support. But it also doesn't want to allow them to support themselves so that they can be sustainable. So without any support and without the right to work, incredible endemic poverty in the community, obviously, people packed into really tight spaces just to survive. But, you know, admittedly, as crowded as these conditions are, at least they're alive, at least they're safe, at least they're away from what they fled from, and at least they're able to breathe fresh air without the sword of Damocles hanging above their head. Okay, let's say that much. But it didn't last long, because the government of Netanyahu spent, you know, a billion shekels to build this fence on the border to cut off the African continent, right? Because Israel is in Northeast Africa. And so by building this border, this border fence, it's cutting off the African continent from Asia. And now no more Africans can get over the border, okay? The immigration rate has trickled to negligibly nil. And so now there's just these 66,000. At this point, the government could have said, okay, we've stopped the wave of migration. There's only 66,000. That's less than a single percent, you know? But even that less than 1% is too much, too many non-Jews in the country, too many non-white non-Jews. And so they've got to drive them all out. So the government starts cracking down and demanding that they renew their visas every few months, every 2 months, every 1 month, until people are standing outside and they're sleeping outside. And then the government starts sending in security forces to sweep in wherever African people can be found and just arrest arresting people willy-nilly and dragging them down and checking their papers. Are you Jewish or aren't you Jewish? If you're not and you don't have a right to be here, and then we round you up off the streets of Tel Aviv. And they round up these African men in the thousands and they take them down to the desert. And they build this desert detention center on the border with Egypt. It's just, there's nothing there. There's nowhere to go. You know, it's just surrounded by sand in every direction and just by army firing ranges. So there's nothing that they can do there. They can walk around the camp. They have furloughs in the daytime, so they're allowed to walk in circles, but that's about it. And this is their fate. The government's plan, which they've stated outright, is, and I quote, to make their lives miserable. The idea is by making their lives miserable, they will coerce these people to self-deport, so-called. And it works, because when people who fled for their freedom realize that they're condemned to live in this detention center for perhaps indefinitely, then, you know, they just figure, okay, well, I'd rather die on my feet than live on my knees. I'd rather go back and die in my own home country than be imprisoned for the rest of my life in this strange land. Realizing that they'll never have any sense of normalcy, some of them agree to self-deport, thousands in fact. But at least what Israel could have done, at the very least, if you wanted to kick out all these African people, because you can't stand having them around, at the very least, negotiate some kind of, you know, scenario where these people can find solace, can find refuge in some other country, at least negotiate a place for them to go where they will have refugee status. But no, Israel sends 68% of those right back to Sudan and Eritrea, right back to the tortures they fled from. Of those that it sent to other countries, those orange countries labeled here on this map, they did nothing to ensure that they would have their refugee rights respected. And since then, those Africans that they expelled have since spread out across the entire, you know, length and breadth of Africa and Europe, from Scandinavia in the north down to South Africa in the south, because just seeking out their refugee rights, just trying to find a place where they can live the rest of their lives as human beings. And some of these people, if you can imagine this, who were living in Israel, then kicked out the country, were since captured by ISIS and executed. So if you can imagine this, kicked out of Israel because they weren't Jews, and then executed by ISIS because they weren't Muslims. So this is the fate. Now, in Israel, of course, in that detention center, they held a ceremony for those people who died. These were their comrades. These were people that they'd lived with, that they were friends with. And we see these photos coming out of Europe, especially in the Mediterranean, because it's not only Israel facing this issue. I mean, we now have 50 million refugees in the world. That's the most amount of refugees that have existed on the planet since World War II. So it's a massive, massive problem that we all have to face. You know, every country in the world has to deal with it and start being part of the solution. When we see these photos of people crawling onto the beaches with their last shreds of energy, or bodies being pulled out of the Mediterranean. Now, when you see photos like this, you know, you're horrified. You know, you wish that there was something that you could do to help these people. But unfortunately, the sickening response from the Israeli government is just the opposite. After one of those boats, you know, drowned in the Mediterranean, taking down 1,000 African refugees with it, instead of expressing, regret that maybe Israel could have taken in more, it did just the opposite. Israel's Minister of Transportation, Israel Katz, after learning of that, he posts on Facebook a photo. He writes, "See how correct the government policy was? You can give us a compliment. Proud that he did his level best to drive out the Africans and ensure that none would find refuge in Israel. Proud that this is the fate that he's responsible for."